I'm Kevin Hatchard, and this is the Ultimate Sports Podcast. Coming up this week, we've got a transfer special as we look at the latest twists and turns in the summer market. We'll talk tennis after winning Wimbledon. Where does Andy Murray go from here? We'll discuss Tapegate, one of the most ridiculous stories of the year. And we'll tell you about a great offer for young cricket fans as former England skipper Alex Stewart joins us. Well, I'm delighted to be joined by the sports broadcaster Toby Gillis, who was amusing me before we came on air with various Chewbacca impressions, which we won't furnish you with just yet. We'll leave it tantalising as a possible prospect later down the line. Let's talk football, Toby, because the summer really has been marked by a number of transfer sagas, so let's go through them. We'll start with Luis Suarez, the latest comments from the Liverpool owner, John W. Henry, saying that Suarez is not for sale at any price. It would be ludicrous to sell him to Arsenal, who are direct rivals for a Champions League spot. And he says, even if a foreign club like Real Madrid came in, it would be too late to find a replacement. So Liverpool seem pretty set in their ways that they're not going to release him.
Well, the only bit of that I don't agree with is that Arsenal are direct rivals for a Champions League spot, because I don't think Liverpool are anywhere close to being
even
a Champions
Suarez?
League team. Not really, no. I'm not convinced that they bought well enough. I think that there seems to be all sorts of question marks over their defence. It looks like Skrtel might go, and possibly even Agger, judging by some of the rumours that are around at the moment. But the rest of it, we've spoken off air, and I absolutely agree with your sentiments. I think Liverpool have played this totally straight down the line. They seem convinced that this clause in his contract, which he thinks means if a bid of more than 40 million comes in, he's allowed to leave. Liverpool seem convinced that that's not the case.
And Gordon Taylor, the PFA chief exec, confirmed that this week,
yeah,
that
absolutely.
That's not a release clause.
So on that basis, you know, ball is entirely in Liverpool's court. And if they feel that they've got a player who they want to keep, and believe more probably importantly now that they can control him, because I suspect that they wouldn't want a player like that to be rotting in the reserves.
Yeah.
You've got to remember he has got a contract for another 4 years yet. So from that point of view, assuming they've decided that they think that they can keep him in the team and get him playing again, then I think they're doing absolutely the right thing.
And Suarez made the mistake, really, of extending his contract last summer. If he wanted to angle for a move, he should have run that contract down a bit further, and then he would have had a much stronger position. But he certainly hasn't endeared himself to the Liverpool fans. He said in an interview a few days ago, Liverpool promised me I could leave if we failed to qualify for the Champions League. Brendan Rodgers says that's simply not true. And he got a standing ovation during the testimonial for Steven Gerrard, the win over Olympiakos, which he barely acknowledged. So he's got a bit of bridge building to do if Liverpool don't release him.
The one thing I would imagine about Luis Suarez is that I don't think Liverpool would have too much of a problem on their hands getting him back in the team if he was to stay beyond the end of the transfer window, because I'm not totally convinced that he knows how to play any other way.
Yeah.
I think he's probably got that in his head that once he's on the pitch, he'll try his heart out. He's probably a little bit like, say, a Carlos Tevez in many ways. You know, he's single-minded when he's on the pitch. You wouldn't expect, say, you remember when Joleon Lescott was angling for a move to Manchester City from Everton. He played the first game of the season and Everton lost 6-1 to Arsenal. And, you know, he was pretty much roundly derided for his performance that day. I don't think you'd see a similar sort of issue with Luis Suarez. I wouldn't be surprised if it does take, well, obviously it's going to be till, I think it's October that he'll be back from his ban,
yeah.
So he's got a lot of time to think about it. But if the transfer window goes, I don't think there'll be an issue getting him back in the team, and I think he'll probably still be the star that that Liverpool fans remember. And in the end, you know, how's he going to win them back? Probably by scoring a load of goals, maybe getting them at least closer to the Champions League. And if they're in the Champions League next summer, then he may well come out, a bit like when Wayne Rooney first asked for a transfer from Manchester United the initial time, you know, and he sort of came out and said, well, I clearly made a mistake. They went on and won things. Maybe if he can get Liverpool in the Champions League in a year's time, we'll be hearing a Luis Suarez interview going, I made a massive mistake. I'm really sorry and I'm glad I stayed.
Suarez with plenty to chew over the next few
weeks
while he sits out for his ban for biting. We'll move on to Gareth Bale then and his on-off move to Real Madrid. So the papers would have us believe all kinds of figures bandied around. It's believed that the Spurs chairman Daniel Levy has met with his Real Madrid counterpart Florentino Perez and they've discussed the potential transfer. But this is one of the more slow-moving deals, isn't it? Because Bale hasn't said anything publicly, so he's not tried to force the issue. We've had no confirmation of a formal bid from Real Madrid. And the longer it goes towards the end of the transfer window, the less likely it looks.
I'm so bored of this one. But probably because nothing's really happened. I mean, you know, the suggestion, as you said, is that there was a meeting between Levy and Perez in Miami because they were both playing in that pre-season tournament. And it was an opportunity for them to meet up. Levy has clearly got it in his head that I suspect he would sell for whatever figure is in his head. There's a suggestion that he wants £104 million, which I think is either 115 or 120 million euros, that Real Madrid have sort of offered him, you know, 100 million euros, which I think works out at about 86 million pounds. So there's around about a 20 million difference. And then, of course, there's this suggestion of, well, Real Madrid want to pay in instalments. Tottenham would want it up front. It would be bonkers to suggest a club, any club, even the size of Real Madrid, have got 100 million just sitting there to just hand over immediately. I would have thought maybe it would end up being two instalments with, you know, maybe 50-50, maybe a little bit more coming.
Still haven't paid off the Modric deal.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, there's that would be, I'm sure, a cause for concern for Levy. But I'm not totally sure I agree with you that the longer this goes on, the less likely it is to happen. I think I'd more expect Bale to leave Spurs than Suarez to leave Liverpool, probably, despite Levy's tough negotiating stances.
I think the only thing is, I agree with you to an extent, but the difference now, I think, with Spurs, because obviously we're used to Spurs running it right to the edge of the window to get the best possible deal. Yeah. I think the difference now is that Levy used to have a manager who would accept that in Harry Redknapp. I'm not sure Villas-Boas will accept it in the same way. He was on at Levy consistently to get him a striker, and eventually Levy has done that and bought him Roberto Soldado from Valencia. I think Villas-Boas certainly doesn't accept the way Spurs do business in the same way Redknapp did, and I think he will push for as quick a resolution as possible, if only to know what he's got for the season ahead, because it's a big season for Spurs.
I think that as a manager, you're preparing for several situations at any one time. It's a bit like when a team is in the Championship and they're wondering whether they're going to get in the playoffs, possibly automatic, or maybe not in the playoffs, you know, and they've sort of got three scenarios with which to plan for. And, you know, I would have thought that Villas-Boas has got plans in place, possibly even, if you know, made tentative bids for players on the basis of, if Bale goes, you know, let's find out availabilities, potential prices, that sort of thing. And yeah, I'm sure you're right that he wouldn't want it to go down to the very final day, but I'll bet you it doesn't take him more than 3 or 4 days to bring in a few replacements if Bale was to go.
We'll finish this section with Manchester United because a few lines regarding them, the first of which is a transfer avenue that has slammed shut, and that's Cesc Fabregas. They made two separate bids for the former Arsenal captain, but he says he doesn't want to leave Barcelona and Barcelona don't want to sell. So that one's pretty much dead in the water, isn't it?
David Moyes is under a huge amount of pressure, isn't he? This has not been a good start to his management time at Manchester United. And I don't think there's any doubt, you know, the next question I suspect you're going to ask me is about Wayne Rooney. I don't think there's any doubt that the Fabregas deal and the Rooney sale are intrinsically linked. He can't sell Wayne Rooney without a mega superstar on his way in at the same time. And so I think that this quote from Fabregas basically saying, you know, I've dreamt of being winning things with Barcelona as a boy. Nobody's going to take that away from me, is the quote from Fabregas. I don't think there's any doubt that him saying that has affected whether Wayne Rooney leaves Manchester United or not, because I'm not sure, and there's now a suggestion that Fellaini will be the man that Moyes targets rather, you know, as a midfield player, which I don't think anyone would argue United do need to strengthen. I don't think he's enough, even if they got Baines as well, which is another suggestion that, you know, he might get a double swoop to Everton for his two old players. I'm not sure they're big enough names, big enough targets to appease Manchester United fans, who may have turned against Rooney to some extent, but still, they'd still have to bring in a mega name if they're going to sell Wayne Rooney.
I was told, and you can never go with these things completely, but I was told from somebody that is fairly well connected in Spain that Ronaldo conversation has taken place. Doesn't mean that there have been any serious talks, doesn't mean that it's anywhere close to happening. But that idea was at least in United's heads. Can you see that happening this summer?
No.
Well, there we go. That's that then. They haven't got many options, have they? Really? I mean, most of the big players have gone. Your Cavani's, your Falcao's, they've all gone. So there aren't many avenues.
You're a German football expert. There's two I've heard. One is a suggestion that Lewandowski is now so annoyed with Dortmund that he might be prepared to not go to Bayern Munich.
I think they've got to the stage now where Dortmund are not prepared to let him go under any circumstances.
To anywhere.
No, I think they feel they need to have another good season, and their best way of doing that is to have Lewandowski for another year. They feel that that's enough to give them success in the Champions League and another crack at Bayern in the league. I'd be very, very surprised if they change their stance between now and the end of the transfer window. Is the other one Schweinsteiger?
Well, Schweinsteiger's been mentioned, but somebody mentioned Royce to me.
I think that's another one that I would be extremely surprised. I think Dortmund are in a situation where they've lost Götze to Bayern Munich. And I think now that Mario Götze, who was the attacking heartbeat of their team, is gone, I think if they were to let Royce go as well, I think that would be extremely damaging. And he's made a really, really good start to pre-season. He looked good in the Super Cup against Bayern. I'd be hugely surprised. The other one is Bastian Schweinsteiger, yeah, which I've seen now. That might have legs only because Bayern do have, a surplus of defensive midfielders. It's a bit dismissive to call him a defensive midfielder, but players in that kind of pivot role in front of the back four. Now, Schweinsteiger's, done his time with Munich. He's won pretty much everything there is to win. That would be a challenge that might interest him. But if it's going to happen, you'd think it would have to happen fairly soon because Bayern certainly won't want to let it go too far into the window. It's more likely, but I'd still be surprised if that was the case. So you do wonder what Manchester United have
the,
left.
The only
for.
Other brief suggestion there was for a while, of course, was Marchisio at Juventus, who's been linked. Even Marchisio, I suppose he's an Italian international, and a player that of real quality, but he doesn't quite have that name, certainly not in England, I would have thought. Again, no. That might appease the United fans as a massive sign. I wonder whether actually they'd prefer Fellaini. And I think
they know Fellaini,
would be
don't
a,
they? And Fellaini's
played
well against
success.
Them. Yeah,
I think he'd
think
be
so.
A huge success at Manchester United. And they absolutely need that type of player. He's spoken publicly many times about, all right, I've played further forward under David Moyes in the past. But if you look at the players that he's got at United now, that's not an issue, to play someone like, say, a Kagawa off Van Persie, assuming Rooney were to leave. So he could use Fellaini in the place he really wants to be used, which is a defensive, a more defensive-minded midfielder. And him and Carrick as a partnership, I think, looks a real mouth-watering prospect.
Well, the only way to appease the fans ultimately is to win, isn't it? And that's what he's going to have to
not
do.
Not going to happen at the moment in my head. Running. Third at the moment for me.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Well, of course, Moyes' first competitive match is on Sunday. That's at Wembley Stadium. United will take on Wigan in the Community Shield. Of course, United, the Premier League champions. Wigan, the FA Cup winners from last season. Wigan, of course, have already made an excellent start to the Championship season. They won 4-0 away at Barnsley in their opening match. Well, let's switch our attention to cricket then. The fourth test ongoing at time of recording, but one thing we can talk about is Tapegate. Ridiculous accusations from the Australian broadcaster Channel 9 that players, including Kevin Peterson, which is the one that was named, have been using silicone tape on their bats to fool hotspot cameras. Now, Peterson reacted angrily to this and said that the allegations were hurtful lies. The England captain, Alistair Cook, has called them a load of rubbish, while Michael Clarke, his Australian counterpart, has said that it's been a subject of some mirth in the dressing room. Well, let's hear from both camps. We'll hear from Australia's Steve Smith. And we'll hear from the England bowler, Graham Onions.
I don't think any of us have done anything with silicone on our bats. We know that we put fiberglass tape on the front, and that's purely for protection of the bat to try and make it last longer. Obviously, a lot of people have their favourite bats and put tape and what have you around them, and that's purely to make our favourite bats last as long as they can. I guess it's just in the spirit of the game not to do that sort of thing. So, yeah, look, we haven't even discussed anything about that, trying to, you know, cheat the system at all. So, yeah, nothing to do with that at all.
Completely blown out of proportion, really. It just doesn't seem right. And I know that England players would never put anything on their bats. You know, tape's been used to mend cracks, or to people have favourite bats to try and last as long as possible. It sounds completely silly to even think that people are putting things on their bats to aid or to try and help them to try and, say, cover up decisions. You know, I can say that we don't put anything on our bats, and we, you know, we play the game as fair as you can, as I'm sure that Australians do as well. I mean, it's a huge accusation, and it's outrageous, really. I mean, from our point of view, I mean, it was the first time we're obviously talking about it just now in the changing rooms, and obviously the excitement of me getting called up and coming into the squad and seeing the lads again from obviously missing out at Old Trafford, to be involved and have these discussions, it seems a little bit unfair, a little bit wrong, really. So I think we could maybe move on a little bit and try and just talk about this test match, because the last test match was a good one. It was close, and I'm sure we're going to have another one coming up now.
Toby, this is absurd, isn't it?
It's a serious allegation, that's for sure.
Very serious.
I would have thought that if I can't remember the name of the channel in Australia.
Channel 9.
Channel 9. If,
respected if, channel as well.
Absolutely. If they don't have some sort of evidence, I wouldn't be at all surprised if there's going to be sort of legal issues with this, because there's huge ramifications to the possibility. I mean, you know, I sort of liken it. It's almost like performance-enhancing drugs if they ever did something like that, isn't it? It's you know, they found a way to beat a system that's supposed to, you know, firm up the integrity of decision-making within the sport. It's quite an astonishing accusation. And, you know, Kevin Peterson made a point, didn't he, when he was so angry about this, and he sort of tweeted in great detail, and he said, well, you know, it would be... You know, maybe be a benefit in theory for an outside edge, but not for an inside edge when I'm probably about to get done for LBW. Another thought I had, and you know, we're talking absolute fractions, but why would you put something on your bat that is, again, absolute fractions, going to make it ever so slightly wider, more chance of a nick?
I mean
that would seem bonkers as well. The only thing I did think about what Peterson said there was, well, could he not just put this, I'm not suggesting that he's done this for one moment, but could a batsman not just put it on one side of the bat and not the inside?
Yeah, it doesn't always work like that.
Is there a suggestion that he's
wrapped
it round? I'm not quite sure what the technical suggestion was.
Yeah, because if you get something that kind of jags back out towards off stump and catches the pad, then it could, in theory, you know, you might have got a nick on the outside. You'd have to be a bit jammed up to do it, but... Yeah, it's a
can't imagine
bonkers allegation. Like very, very surprised. Well, let's move on to something a bit more wholesome then, and a scheme that's being run by the ECB, which involves all 18 first-class counties and Scotland. Free tickets being offered to children attending Yorkshire Bank 40 games throughout this month. Games free of charge for any child visiting any of the selected matches if they're with a paying adult. Now, there are 9 games in the Yorkshire Bank 40 on Sunday, and 7 of those are including this offer. Kids going free with a paying adult. Let's just list them for you. Hampshire against Essex, Leicestershire against Yorkshire, Middlesex against Unicorns, Scotland against Durham, Surrey against Derbyshire, Warwickshire against the Netherlands, and Worcestershire against Kent Spitfires. If you want more information about the offer, then that's available at ecb.co.uk/kidsgofree. And we've been talking to the former England captain, Alex Stewart, about the scheme.
Well, I think it's an absolutely great initiative. It's an opportunity for kids to go free when they go into the Yorkshire Bank 40 matches. The all 18 first-class counties will offer free ticket to the kids for specified matches. And I hope that they take up that offer.
Well, Stuart's also said that it's worth bearing in mind that while we focus on the England players playing well in the Ashes, of course, you've got to start somewhere, and the county system is vital for England to do well.
The publicity that the Ashes bring doesn't just go towards England v Australia, but I actually think it filters down into the county system. The counties are the feeder system to the England team. So when the likes of Graham Swan, Stuart Broad, Alastair Cook were performing well for England, it's the counties that have helped create their talent and really made sure that they've matured into England cricketers.
Andy Murray is back in tennis action after his memorable win at Wimbledon, but he had a mixed return to action. He beat Marcel Granollers in his first game back at the Montreal Masters, but disappointingly then lost in straight sets to Ernest Gulbis. And Toby, a big tennis fan, a big watcher of the tour, and it's a tricky one now, isn't it? Because he's crossed off the first Grand Slam off the list. He's crossed Wimbledon off the list now. You wouldn't doubt his motivation because obviously he's a very driven guy, but there is an element of it being after the Lord Mayor's show, isn't there?
Yeah, he's finished.
It's the end.
It's all over.
Slams on retire.
Yeah, I mean, I watched both his matches at the Montreal Masters, and it took quite a fight in the second set against Granollers to ensure that it didn't go into a third. He was 5-2 down and had to perform one of his miracle comebacks that he's so well known for now. I have to say that, you know, I sort of thought he was going to do it against Gulbis as well, but it wasn't his best. Although actually he came out afterwards and insisted that he actually hit the ball much cleaner than he had against Granollers, and he said that he was incredibly nervous to come out against Granollers as well. You know, his first match as Wimbledon champion, and I'm sure it's been an incredible month for him.
Yeah,
a complete transformation in many ways. You know, he was already a world megastar, but I think his army of fans is increasing with every victory, and you know, to win Wimbledon, which is the tournament in tennis around the world for absolutely everybody, there's no argument about that, you know, was an astonishing achievement that brought tears to my eyes, and I still, anytime they mention it, I still, you know, get that prang of pride that
he's
we finally
an emotional
had a British
chap,
win.
He's an emotional
absolutely
chap.
I mean, I'm a huge Andy Murray fan. I don't think this has been an ideal week, you know, bearing in mind that we've got his defence of his US Open starting in now, you know, a few days' time at the point of recording this. So he will, I've no doubt, be having some tough hitting, I'm sure, in training over the next week or so before he starts the defence of his US Open campaign.
He'll have the American swing, when he'll have Cincinnati, and I think there's a couple of
US
tournaments.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not easy now for him because he's there to be shot at. Most people think that at this moment in time, obviously prior to this tournament anyway, he's certainly for the last few months been the best player in the world. Of course, he's beaten Djokovic in two of his last three Grand Slam final appearances and lost to him in another. So it's going to be, you would have thought that he'll get his form together for the US Open. There's absolutely no guarantees, but in theory,
never gone into a Grand Slam as defending champion.
No,
either.
He hasn't. It's a new experience for him. But you know, I mean, for all I say, it's not been an ideal week in Montreal. It's not the end of the world losing to Ernest Gulbis. When he first came along, there was suggestions that he would be right up there with the Murrays, with the Nadals, with the Federers and Djokovic's. And there's no argument that he's got the talent. He's incredibly, frustratingly inconsistent. He's got major problems with his forehand. His backhand is one of the best shots around. But he's capable of shocks like that. You would think over five sets, should he meet Murray, I should say, in the early rounds of the US, you would think that Murray would have enough. And even in the third round of the Montreal Masters, there was enough sort of opportunities for Murray that you thought he might have been able to turn it round. But it's a tournament that he's done well in the past, twice a winner in, I think, 2009 and 10. Djokovic has won the last couple. Djokovic now big favourite to win the Montreal Masters, particularly with no Federer. Nadal, who knows what's going to happen with from one match to the next. But you know, Thomas Burdick is out, David Ferrer is out, you know, so depending
him,
on what point that you're listening to this podcast, you know, I'm predicting now that this is a Djokovic tournament, and he would love that going into the US Open having won another tournament.
Well, that's it for this week from Toby Gillis and myself, Kevin Hatchard. It's goodbye for now. And if you stayed all the way to the end of the podcast, you can hear the Chewbacca impression right now.
Bah!
in a jolly mood there, Chewbacca. Goodbye for now.